By downloading or listening to this podcast, you are agreeing to Moody's legal terms and conditions found at moodys.com/disclaimer, including that the information provided is not investment or financial advice, and that Moody's will not be liable for losses arising from your use of the information.
Inflation has taken hold in many economies as they continue to recover from the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic amid persistent supply shortages. And in response, central banks are beginning to hike interest rates. Deals backed by loans to weaker borrowers, such as unsecured consumer and SME loans, face the biggest performance deterioration risks as a result of inflation among structured finance transactions. And higher rates will weaken structured finance deals that pay floating rates, such as leveraged loans that back CLOs. Meanwhile, in Asia-Pacific structured finance markets, inflation and rising rates are not as big of a concern, although they are rising. I'm Aaron Johnson, and this is Moody's Talks, Securitization Spotlight. In today's episode, I will talk with Madhavi Bokhil of our Credit Strategy and Research Group about our current inflation and interest rate forecasts, and then I'll bring on Structured Finance Group analysts Peter McNally in New York, Frank Cervini in Frankfurt, and Marie Lam in Hong Kong, so we can discuss the impact of inflation on various asset classes. But before we get started, I'd like to encourage our listeners, if you have not already, to subscribe to Securitization Spotlight and to also check out some of our other monthly podcasts, like Muniland, where this month our analysts discuss revenue challenges affecting higher education and the effect of gas tax suspension on states' capacity to meet bond payments. And with that, Madhavi, thanks for joining us and kicking off our episode this month.
Thanks, Aaron, for having me.
Now, to get us started, what have we seen in terms of price increases, and for how long has it been going on? Are there certain segments of the market that are kind of driving up prices more than others?
So we've been in this rising inflationary environment since April 2021. So we've been in this for a year now. And while countries around the world are experiencing different inflationary pressures, some common factors have driven inflation up since April last year. Food and energy prices, for instance, fuel costs in particular, input costs and goods prices are also up because of the supply challenges that you mentioned. And firms have been able to pass on these higher costs to consumers because of the strong demand. Now in the US, services inflation is relatively more subdued relative to goods prices, but then labor costs are rising, rents are rising. So we are also seeing a broader pickup in inflation. So we've been in this for a year, and the inflation is still mainly concentrated in the side of food prices, energy prices, goods prices in particular.
And before going on the air, we were talking about the different regions, and you kind of noted that APAC is kind of just starting to get a little bit more inflation, or inflation starting to rise a little bit quicker there now. So are they kind of lagging Europe and the US in terms of inflation?
Yes. So inflationary pressures actually vary quite a bit across the globe. Inflation has been particularly high in the US. It's been rising in Europe as well. Although even in Europe, energy component makes up bulk of the inflationary pressures. And if you remove that energy component and look at just core goods, the inflationary pressures in Europe are somewhat less than in the US. In emerging markets too, there's quite a bit of variation in their experience of rising inflation. In EMs, it's really been high energy and food prices, which have been really made worse by Ukraine and Russia conflict. Now, coming to APAC and coming directly to your question, in APAC, consumer price inflation has been relatively low or slow to rise, in part because of differences in exposure to energy prices across countries, and also because the recovery in the consumer demand has been less robust than the US. So the sensitivity of headline inflation to energy costs and other supply shocks is somewhat less in APAC, and that's what we've seen. That said, we are starting to see a pickup in inflation there, and it's most evident in producer price inflation.
As the different governments around the world try to combat inflation, what kind of steps are we seeing central banks take? Obviously, kind of the big one is interest rates. Is there a region where we're seeing more aggressive monetary policy than others?
typically, central banks look past inflation from supply side shocks, which is what we've largely experienced. Now, we have seen emerging market central banks reacting a lot more quickly to higher prices, especially central banks which have had a history of high inflation. So in Latin America, Brazil, Mexico, for instance, started raising interest rates as early as mid last year. Other central banks are now pursuing that same strategy. And that's because what we've seen is multiple supply shocks on top of one another, demand and supply imbalances that have lasted longer than we had previously expected, supply chain bottlenecks, now renewed energy price shock from the Russia-Ukraine crisis. All of this are threatening to keep inflation higher for longer. And so it's understandable that central banks are now around the world looking to reduce a monetary policy accommodation through a mix of policies, certainly removing or reversing COVID-related liquidity and monetary policy support, including raising interest rates, but also reducing the size of balance sheets and so forth.
And I think you're talking about payment plans, debt forgiveness, that kind of stuff too, right?
Absolutely. All of the emergency support that was provided to the economy during COVID, central banks are looking to reduce that. In part, this is an inflation story. Also, economies have recovered largely from COVID, and there we are seeing central banks normalizing policy.
Now, we've seen the beginning of rate hikes. Where do we see monetary policy going from here looking forward? And as far as inflation, do we see it peaking anytime soon, slowing?
On inflation, we expect inflation to ease from current levels eventually. But just to keep something in mind, there's quite a bit of uncertainty around our inflation projections. Much will depend on how energy prices move and how long it takes for supply chain bottlenecks to ease. As for the Fed, yes, the Fed has raised the Fed funds rate one time in March. We do expect them to deliver a series of rate hikes and normalize the Fed funds rate as quickly as possible. We are expecting another 6 rate hikes this year, 25 basis points, and then another 4 next year. But that said, we also believe that it's entirely possible that the Fed raises rates even quicker by more than 25 basis points, even in some of the meetings, as it tries to normalize policy as rapidly as it can without endangering the labor market recovery.
Well, very helpful, Madhavi. Thanks for joining us and kind of setting the stage for us this month.
Thank you.
All right. Now, turning to the structured finance team. We'll start with Peter and Frank. Thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Happy to be here, Aaron.
Before we get started, I want to be clear. The level of inflation and subsequent rate hikes that we're predicting will really have a limited impact on structured finance transactions for a number of reasons. But let's take a look at the types of debt we think are most at risk of performance deterioration going forward, namely in the event of a more sustained period of inflation than we forecast. Frank, why don't you kick us off?
Yes, sure, Aaron, with pleasure. So very generally speaking, structured finance collateral with exposure to weaker borrowers and floating rate debt is more vulnerable to inflation and rising interest rates. This holds true for both corporate and consumer debt, particularly in the non-mortgage space.
When we say vulnerable to inflation and interest rates, it's the weaker borrowers that are most susceptible to inflation, and it's the floating rate products that are most susceptible to rising rates, right?
That is absolutely correct, Aaron.
Can you elaborate a little bit on how and why inflation is such a concern for unsecured loans or SME loans?
Sure, Aaron. To start with the unsecured borrowers. So borrowers in unsecured consumer loans have among the weakest affordability among consumers and thus are more likely to face budget constraints as a result of rising prices. In addition, underwriting criteria also typically do not contemplate high inflation, while they vary across lender type, with high street banks being more conservative than specialized lenders. As regards SMEs, SME loans and leases are largely European collateral type, by the way, and SMEs' vulnerability to inflation primarily depends on their pricing power, which varies again by industry sector, country, and company size. The larger a company, the more likely it can pass on incremental costs from rising input prices to customers. Micro SMEs, by default, have the least pricing power. SMEs with predominantly floating rate loans and leases, such as those in Italy, Spain, and Germany, are most vulnerable to interest rate hikes.
Now, some types of mortgages, which are typically relatively safe from inflation and rising rates, can also be vulnerable. Frank, can you go over a couple of those?
As you said, there are a couple of pockets of vulnerability in the mortgage space. So first of all, across all countries, the most vulnerable mortgages are those originated late in the inflationary cycle, hence those with smaller equity buffers. On the other hand, more seasoned transactions typically build up equity buffers as borrowers paid down their mortgages and house prices increase. Mortgages of first-time borrowers are also relatively vulnerable because they typically have smaller financial buffers, higher LTVs, and weaker affordability. Now coming to the UK, UK non-conforming mortgages is the most vulnerable type of mortgage collateral to inflation because of borrowers' typically weaker credit profiles. Mortgage payments for those borrowers typically take up a relatively large share of their income. Non-conforming borrowers are also more likely to be self-employed, which tends to generate a more variable income stream. Lastly, collateral with short fixed rate terms of 5 years or less, which represents the vast majority of UK and Irish mortgages, are more vulnerable to inflation than collateral with longer term fixed rates. These borrowers will face refinancing stress when their fixed rate period ends.
Let's turn to Peter to talk a little bit about the effect of interest rate hikes. Peter, can you go over a couple asset classes that we do consider at greater risk of rising interest rates?
Sure. These would be transactions that feature borrowers that pay floating rates. These would include collateralized loan obligations or CLOs. In the US in particular, it would also include single asset, single borrower CMBS and some private student loan ABS.
Now, those asset classes' vulnerability really comes from rising rates, like you said, and given the fact that they largely have floating rate portfolios. I'm speaking namely to CLOs.
Yeah, in the case of CLOs, these are assets, they're loans to low-rated borrowers that makes them particularly vulnerable to interest rate hikes, meaning that their increasing debt service obligations could eventually lead to higher asset default rates in the CLO portfolios. Now, we do think that most U.S. corporate issuers, even low-rated ones, are in a good position to withstand rising rates, at least this year, given that most of them have sufficient liquidity.
Yeah, I think that's an important point to make, that this is all relative risk. Now, conduit CMBS typically have fixed rates, but single asset, single borrower deals often do have floating rates. Can you go walk us through a couple of the points affecting those deals?
Right. So those floating rate borrowers would have the risk of increasing debt service obligations, similar to what I described for CLOs. But on the other hand, they may also have the opportunity to increase their revenues through the ability to charge higher rents. So that would offset the higher mortgage payments, helping to cover the increases in their mortgage expenses.
Student loan ABS is also unique to the US with some floating rate exposure. Again, just very briefly walk us through those risks.
Private student loan ABS transactions can have different mixes of fixed and floating rate borrowers. Some transactions have exclusively fixed rate and some have exclusively floating rate borrowers and some have a mix. It'll depend on the shelf and the vintage. Some transaction sponsors have pretty equal mixes of fixed and floating rate collateral. Some, particularly refi lenders, may have very low percentages of floating rate borrowers in the single digits as a percentage of the outstanding assets.
Now I want to get the input kind of both you and Frank, Peter. Obviously, those rising rates and rising prices in general also have knock-on effects. It's not solely the direct impact on the transactions. For example, cars are more expensive or debt service costs increase. Can you both kind of walk us through a little bit about those incremental risks?
Even in sectors in which you have largely or exclusively fixed rate borrowers, rising rates can eventually have an impact on performance. For example, auto loan borrowers typically pay fixed rates, but as you mentioned, affordability in that sector has already declined over the past couple of years. So while rising rates won't affect existing borrowers that pay fixed rates, It will weaken the loan affordability for borrowers that take out new loans.
I totally agree with what Peter said. And maybe we could add that, say, inflation in general stresses consumer borrowers' budgets in several ways, including via higher consumer prices, such as energy costs and higher debt burdens resulting from higher house or car prices in the case of new securitization transactions. Rising rates also increase SMEs' already high debt burdens, reflecting higher input prices for their machinery, equipment, and premises on the back of already higher leverage after extensive use of publicly guaranteed loans during the pandemic in some countries.
Well, thanks, Peter and Frank, for that kind of Western-centric overview. Now we're going to go out east to Marie Lam to talk about APAC. Marie, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, while rising, inflation is not yet the challenge for APAC that it is in the U.S. and Europe. But let's look at how interest rate movements will affect transactions we rate there, starting with Australia.
Thanks, Aaron. Yeah, a rising rate is actually negative for the performance of the mostly floating rate loans in RMBS portfolios that we rate in Australia. However, the risk should be small because the rates would still be low by historical standards. At origination, lenders assess borrowers' capacity to repay debts at interest rates of around 2.5 to 3% higher than the current rates. So rate rise will pose the most risk for mortgages with high loan balances and those where repayment amounts are close to borrowers' maximum repayment capacity. Outside RMBS, the loans in the Australian portfolios are fixed rate, and interest rate rise will not increase their repayment amounts. Risks will increase to a small extent when borrowers have other floating rate debt like mortgages. But on balance, the rate environment will be neutral for these loans.
Now, South Korea is also a rising interest rate environment where we rate deals. But those rising rates haven't really affected structured finance transactions we rate there. Is that kind of a factor of different asset classes, Marie?
Well, the central bank's policy rate is rising, and we rate credit card transactions in South Korea. But the credit card interest rates are holding steady. This is because competition for market share in the Korean credit card sector is very strong. So lenders will not readily increase rates. In addition, some credit card rates are already very close to the maximum 20%. So there is little room for further increase. And when the central bank raised rates in August and November last year, credit card rates held steady overall. So the situation is again neutral for the credit card receivables in South Korea.
Now moving on to Japan, where the central bank is holding its monetary policy steady. Are there any asset classes we want to highlight there?
As you pointed out, the rate environment is steady, and it will be neutral for the performance of loans in the structured finance portfolios. If the central bank changes its policy stance and increases interest rates, it will raise loan repayment risks for the floating rate mortgage loans in RMBS. However, the risk will be low overall because rates will still be, again, very low even after it rises. Lenders also assess borrowers' ability to meet loan repayments at interest rates of 3 to 4% during their underwriting process. This 3 to 4% is a lot higher than the current rate of around 1% for loans in the RMBS re-rate.
Lastly, in China, monetary policy is easing as the country continues to try to meet GDP growth targets. This will generally benefit transactions we rate out there in primarily auto ABS that encompasses, right, Marie?
Correct. It's positive for the loan performance in auto ABS that we rate. The loans in the Chinese auto ABS have either fixed or floating rates, and a more liquid market lowers loan payment amounts and reduces refinancing risks for borrowers. Borrowers with fixed-rate auto loans will also benefit from the more liquid market in cases where they have other floating-rate debt like mortgages.
Well, thanks, Peter, Frank, and Marie, for really breaking down how those macro factors that Madhavi discussed are applicable to structured finance. And to our listeners, a reminder to subscribe and pass us along to your friends and coworkers. We look forward to having you back for next month's edition of Securitization Spotlight.